you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, my name is Danny Roth, and this is Everyday Horror. It's a podcast where we watch at least one horror movie for every day in the month of October, and then we talk about it. Today, I'm joined by the creator of Atop the Fourth Wall and History of Power Rangers, the one and only Lewis Linkara Lovehog. Hey, Lewis. Yeah, go for it. All the way in. That's real. That's definitely a real crowd. Unbelievable. You just have an entourage of people that cheer for you everywhere you go at this point, don't you?
Oh, well, of course. I got them all just sitting behind me, just sitting on the futon that I usually record regular episodes of my show. Just like, you know, 20, 30 of them all smashed in on it.
It's a very, very honest peek behind the curtain. They just sit behind you and ask you when the next episode of History of Power Rangers is coming out. When's that coming out?
I'm planning on hopefully getting one out in December because the fans have been demanding a revised version of the Power Rangers in Space episode for quite a while now for Ninja Storm, because people have also been asking about that since that's been ongoing. It'll be done when the show is done and when it's out on DVD.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, not to get sidetracked, but I feel like the work is probably larger than ever. I feel like Power Rangers is the biggest it's been in a really long time.
Mm.
Maybe it's my imagination, but I have found a lot more people talking about it around me. And it was you and people that I knew through you. And now it's much more than that.
It helps that we've had like two major milestones, you know, 20th anniversary, then 25th anniversary most recently, that helps, you know, people come back to want to talk more about it and everything like that. And if I may toot my own horn here, one more project, especially because, you know, horror-based stuff right now. During October, I also do a daily show called Long Box of the Damned, where I talk about horror comics every single day in a horror host ghoul kind of thing named Morte.
Oh, man, what's, of the ones that you've done already, what's an episode that you would say it's a good one? Either the comic is good or you feel your take on it was really good.
Two different ones. One, if you're looking for something humorous, I did a review of a Barbie comic a year or two ago, which was just Moarte trying to parse out this is the innocence of a Barbie comic, like why is no one killing each other in this kind of thing.
It's spooky as hell.
Yep, and a really good one that really took me by surprise, was not expecting it to be good, comic called The Night Driver, which it feels like it could be a legitimate movie about a traveling salesman who believes he is being stalked by someone who is murdering people around him.
Oh, that's got a little bit of a Creepshow vibe to it. That sounds like if they made a new Creepshow movie, they could have that as like one of the segments. That's cool. All right, so we're not talking about a comic book today. We are talking about a movie. What, Lewis, is the movie?
We are talking about Exorcist 3 or Exorcist 3 Legion, or just that movie that was adapted from Legion.
Yes. In fact, the director's cut, when they showed the title card, it just says Legion. It doesn't even say Exorcist 3.
If I recall correctly, this was a big disagreement with him in the studio, because the idea was he didn't want it. He figured if you call it Exorcist 3, no one's going to see it because he felt it cheapened the movie.
Right. Yes.
To a degree. Because it's just another boilerplate kind of sequel thing versus Legion, which, you know, could mean anything, and you don't necessarily walk into it knowing it's an Exorcist sequel.
Yeah, I think the only Legion that I know that is really successful right now is the FX series. But yeah, I mean, so he in that question is author, and in this case, screenwriter and director William Peter Blatty, who was the man who wrote the original book that the Exorcist original is based on, and also wrote the script for it. But before we sort of get into the complexity of it, why did you pick this one? Why was this the movie you wanted to talk about?
Exorcist 3 is my absolute favorite horror movie of all time. And I know that there's certainly stiff competition out there. But for me, I absolutely love the atmosphere. I love the acting from the various, I want to say leads. You know, technically George C. Scott is the lead in this, but I would say that Brad Dourif especially has a pretty big part in this too. There's this constant sense of dread throughout the movie. It's very dour. It has a hypnotic quality to it that I really enjoy. And it's a slow burn, but especially in the theatrical cut, once it reaches the ending, the buildup is all there.
It definitely, I think that what's interesting about it is that it does have a lot of dread to it. And then there are a couple of moments that are genuinely very scary that will sort of pop out, I think, in a way. And but otherwise, yeah, it's just a constant oppressive sort of feeling where, like, you know that everything is not quite right. It's a really interesting film, and it's very, I am very interested as we talk about it to sort of uncover why this is your favorite horror movie, because I like it too, but gosh, favorite horror movie, I don't know if I'd say that. I don't even know if it's not even my favorite Exorcist movie, which I think still as a purist, or I don't know what, I think it's still probably the original, even it's just its theatrical release. I don't even like the additions that they've made to that movie over time. I like the original release as it stands. That's my, you know, when I think of The Exorcist, that's what I think of. But I also do think of, we did a previous episode where we actually talked about the original, and what always bothers me about the conversation around that film is that people have a tendency only to talk about the third act.
Mm.
Like, that's the only part of the movie that's worth talking about, when in fact, you know, just because the first two acts are very slow moving, they're super necessary. And I think that the third act is nothing without them. All the things that really make the third act have the weight that it does come from those first two acts. And what's sort of interesting in my mind about Exorcist 3 is that I think that the whole movie kind of has the, except for like the very, very end. And we'll also talk about, again, the difference between the original intention and what the theatrical release was. But it seems like the whole movie kind of had that first two acts vibe. Because it's like, it's oppressive. It's unpleasant. You never really feel quite even, like on even footing or really quite safe. But it's also psychological. Let's sort of give a quick outline. What is the plot / elevator pitch for Exorcist 3?
It is 15 years after the original movie, and Lieutenant Kinderman, who was a kind of a secondary character in the first movie, is meeting with Father Dyer, who was also a secondary character in the first movie, and they're getting older, and there's this murder case going on right now that resembles a murder case that had been solved with the killer dead, to the point where, what is this a copycat, or is this or did we catch the wrong guy here? And his investigation leads him to a hospital and a man in cell 11 in the disturbed ward, where to Lieutenant Kinderman's shock and horror, it's Father Karras, who of course died at the end of the first Exorcist. And the implication is that he is possessed and has been somehow going around killing people.
Yeah, it really messes with your mind a little bit, because in the director's cut and in most of the theatrical cut, Father Karras is effectively played by Brad Dourif instead of Jason Miller. And so and in the theatrical cut, where they sort of bounce back and forth in who's portraying the part, I can't tell. This is one of the things that I can't tell if I like it or not. And it is, again, it's one of the changes to the theatrical cut, but like, it definitely messes with you. It definitely makes you feel really on edge and really like you're really not sure. I don't think that Exorcist 3, like when I said, like, what's the plot? I have to be honest, I think that the plot is not really the point. It's really the mood, and it's really the emotions of the people that are within the plot, especially George C. Scott, who obviously is a very, very, very different take on Kinderman, who was a little bit more, I don't want to say bumbling, but, you know, it's a bit of a Columbo. Do you know what I mean? In that original version, he's always kind of playing a little bit dumb to try and lull people that he thinks know more than they want to give up into a false sense of... Yeah, like he's definitely, yeah, like he's kind of sneaking in there. Like in the first movie, I was always surprised that he never, you know, said like, just one more question, sir. Just one more. You possessed her, didn't you? You know, I mean, like, he's that kind of character in the original, but when you get to the third Exorcist movie and they recast with George C. Scott, I mean, if you know anything about George C. Scott, he ain't that guy. He is a very loud, very angry, very intense person. You know, even when he's not shouting, there's always this undercurrent of rage that he has the ability to bring to a character. And I think that's really, it really services the film very well. What was sort of your impression of his take on the character?
The thing is, like I said, it's 15 years later, and I think a lot of it can be summed up in his conversation with Father Dyer right after they just saw A Wonderful Life for like the 30th time. And that's basically that he's, you know, after 15 years on the force, so much death, so much horror, he's become incredibly jaded. I quoted that bit from him when they were doing the investigation of a murdered priest. I'm padding the investigation. That's kind of like what's remains of the of that kind of character, because there's not much else he can do these days. He doesn't believe in God. He does not believe. It seems like he doesn't really have that much of a faith in humanity either. He's going through the motions for the most part, and especially it's depressing for him because he's lost symbols of innocence around him. The first murder victim that we see is a murdered black boy who is part of a police boys club. And it was a pretty horrific death, head cut off. He was crucified. Later they learned that the decapitation wasn't even what killed him. He basically suffocated because of a paralyzing agent that was injected into him.
Yeah, so he was alive as he was slowly being murdered. He experienced the whole murder.
Yep. So it's easy. So it's hard for anybody like that to really go through that and be unaffected unless you're a total monster yourself. So in his case, he wants to do right, but how can you? He asks him, "How can you believe? How can I believe in a God like this when there's so much of this kind of thing going on in the world?" And of course, Father Dyer doesn't really have an answer for him. He just kind of quietly shaken by the description that was given to him.
Sure.
And not made any better when Father Dyer himself becomes a murder victim.
Yeah, it's a really it's really interesting. They set up some stuff between George C. Scott and Ed Flanders, who plays this version of Father Dyer, that I really like. Because Father Dyer, I think, also is sort of at a bit of a crossroads in a way. I think he is still able to appoint to hang on to his faith, but they do kind of briefly have that sort of sardonic conversation, like Kinderman is sort of talking about, like the oddballness of being a person that really doesn't have a lot of faith, particularly, but who is of Jewish descent, kind of having a friendship with a priest who is, you know, still trying to hang on to it. And yeah, sort of the complexity of them and the adorableness of not just their friendship, but yeah, that they go off and see It's a Wonderful Life every year. And it's what I like about it, and what I think sort of gets skated over, is that they're each sort of quizzed on why it is that they're going to go hang out with the other. And they both kind of give the same answer, which is, oh, well, he just gets really busted up this time of year, so I'm going to go help him out, make him feel better. And I like that, you know, the truth is that they're both really busted up and they need each other, but neither of them really wants to cop to it.
Yeah.
Which I think is a kind of nice sort of joining point that kind of sums up what makes
their relationship.
Yeah, I think it sums up their relationship very well. And that's one of those things that, in my opinion, I feel like you kind of have to watch Exorcist 3 more than once to get some of the, there is a lot of nuance, and I think that it would be easy to miss on it.
I just rewatched it in preparation for this, and yeah, they everything that they question they bring up and they explain, and you can see the pieces coming together, especially if you've watched it multiple times.
Yeah, you really do need to. I think it's a movie that is a little dense. And what's interesting to me is that there was a concern, because originally the director who had directed the first Exorcist film was supposed to direct this one as well, but walked because Blatty was trying to make it too film-like, supposedly. And to me, this really feels like a novel plot because of the nuance. It doesn't feel quite as filmic. And for people that don't know, the story is that it was initially going to start as a movie, and then the director left. Freaking, he dropped out, and then Blatty made a novel instead, and the novel was successful, and then people came back around and said, oh, we should probably turn that novel into a movie. And then John Carpenter was going to direct it, but Blatty and him had some disagreements, and it became clear that Blatty really wanted to be in charge from beginning to end. He wanted to kind of have his say on it from soup to nuts, so he ended up doing the whole thing.
Carpenter directing this would be amazing.
Oh, I agree. Like, this is there. Here's the thing. Like, I do like Exorcist 3, but the more you learn about A, the director's cut of the film, and B, some of the other things that they had considered doing, some of the other people that could have been a part of the product, more and more I find myself thinking, like, this thing is in some ways kind of less than the sum of its parts and could have been an even better film. But who knows? I mean, I'm still happy with what we got, but it's weird. The more you know about it, the more, at least for me, I find myself wondering what else we could have seen and what those other interpretations might have been like.
Well, let's start from the ending here, because the major difference between the theatrical cut and the original theatrical cut and the director's cut. I put that in quotations because unfortunately they lost a lot of the original footage, over the years. They fortunately found like a VHS copy of the original cut of the film, which is what the Shock Factory or Scream Factory version uses for their alternate cut. And it's fine, you know, you take what you can get considering, you know, the lost footage and everything like that. But the ending is very different. And personally, I much prefer the theatrical cut.
Interesting.
Yes.
All right. Now, I prefer the director's cut,
flaws,
but that's okay.
But here is my big problem with the theatrical versus the director's. With the director's, it really pulls back on Damien Karras being involved whatsoever in this. Brad Dourif plays the part during the entirety of the movie in the director's cut, which is apparently another thing that was a disagreement with the studio, because apparently I can't remember if it was either the studio or he wanted Brad Dourif throughout the entire thing. And one or the other insisted that Jason Miller be involved in it, mostly because he's pretty much the only returning actor from the original films. And it really works for me because while you can argue that Father Dyer and Kinderman look 15 years older versus, you know, with the different actors, Brad Dourif does not look that old. He does not. He looks considerably younger than them. And Damien Karras has no agency in the director's cut. It's just basically the big climax of the movie is the possessed nurse attacks Kinderman's family. Kinderman goes back in and just shoots him. That's it. That's the end of the movie. And it feels like, what was even the point of all that? Versus the theatrical cut, which has an exorcism scene. It goes badly, but then has Kinderman come back. We get to see the full power of the demon. But Karras manages to pull enough of himself free again to allow Kinderman to shoot him. And now suddenly we've got a story where Karras has a more active role, where we have a brief bit of redemption for him in the end. He gets to be the hero one last time. And it feels like Kinderman has more of a reason to be involved in things, and it feels like there's a bit more of a point. Because part of the Gemini Killer's entire thing has been, I need you to tell people out there that I am the Gemini Killer, and basically tell him this, and, you know, tell people this insane story of demonic possession. And Kinderman's like, I don't believe that you are the Gemini Killer. I think you're just some crazy guy who the doctors are somehow are letting out to kill, you know, for you and stuff like that. And this has an arc then for Kinderman where, yeah, at this point, I believe in all this terrible things, and I believe in you, and I believe in all this, and yeah. belief plays a big part in that, especially with connecting it back to the beginning where he said, where he's basically established that he does not believe in God and all that.
I mean, the thing about Exorcist as a concept is at least in part, and I always found to be one of the most important elements of the story, is that it's there's always somebody that doesn't believe, as a crisis of faith, and then has their faith restored, but in the worst way possible.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what happens to Father Karras in the first movie. And that is why the first two acts are so, so, so critical, and why, you know, the third one wouldn't have its weight without him having his doubts and then being confronted with things that he doesn't want to believe, not because he doesn't want to be faithful, but because they are so terrifying, and then having to face them completely. But yeah, I didn't, you know, for me, it's that the third act of the theatrical cut feels so different. It feels like a completely different movie, for good reason, because it is not the movie that William Peter Blatty had ever intended to make.
Yeah,
it's so, so, so different. And I suppose in a way, you know, I mean, the producers, for people that don't know, basically said, hey, there's no exorcism in this movie. It's called Exorcist. Got to have an exorcism. Yeah, but that was the thing. They were like, hey, this is a sequel to The Exorcist. There's got to be a goddamn exorcism, so do it or else. And he tried to play a game with chicken of that, with them, and he lost. And according to him, basically, you know, the agreement was, we'll let you have one preview screening and see how people react. And Blatty sort of insisted that they brought in a bunch of people that were very tired and zombie-like. Like, they went out of their way to find people that just would not have a reaction to anything, that were borderline comatose, so that they could have their way. I don't know how true that is, but he certainly believed it. And as a result, what we wind up with is a much bigger finale that does tonally feel a lot more similar to the original Exorcist's third act.
We'll also say this in defense of the theatrical cut. It is a very slow moving movie. It is very plotting. It is very, I don't want to say a thinking man's movie, but I would say it is much more cerebral. And this way, it gives us a much more theatrical ending. It gives us something that's actually cinematic. It gives us something we are building up to. Otherwise, the big climax of the film is the attack by the nurse, by the possessed, sorry, not the possessed nurse, the possessed, it is a woman dressed like a nurse, but it is not a nurse. But basically, that becomes a climax. And frankly, again, favorite horror movie, the thing has its flaws, and that sequence is not exactly great.
Yeah, I guess, you know, in my mind, I look at it and I think, well, he's, the whole pitch is he realizes that that the killer is coming after his family. He gets in his cop car. He drives over there very, very quickly. He thinks that, you know, he's safe. Then he almost isn't, and then that point, he has all of the information that he needs. He definitely believes that there is some kind of possession going on, and as a result, goes back and very coldly kills off this character who may or may not be Karras that Brad Dourif is playing. And that I think there's an interestingness, because there is never a point in which Jason Miller is playing that part. You really don't know. And like, there is a much longer sort of speech and a different speech that Brad Dourif gives as to whether or not he is Father Karras. You really don't know. And he and you're sort of led to believe that George C. Scott also doesn't really know one way or the other, but he certainly is convinced that whoever or whatever that is, it's dangerous, and so he just goes back and very coldly, very clinically kills him. And I find that to be very disturbing. I find that to be like, well, he's going to go to jail, right? Like, he doesn't really, like, win in the end. That's not what I find to be sort of interesting, is that, yes, his family is safe, but there's no real proof that he's right in his supposition. We certainly as an audience can believe it, but there's no real reason for the doctors or the nurses or the other police officers to believe that Brad Dourif's character is somehow controlling people.
Yeah.
So his consequences is almost certainly going to be that he goes to jail. So it, for me, feels like not a happy ending. And it feels less triumphant and more ambiguous. And I like that. I certainly understand that that is ultimately far less theatrical and is far less tonally similar to the original, which, you know, for the fact that Father Karras does die in that one, you know, I mean, Reagan is saved and everything seems all right. You know, she kisses the priest on the cheek and gets in the car and everybody's okay. And for the ambiguity that there is in that movie, certainly you do think like, well, they won.
And I feel that the, especially with how dour the third movie is, it needs to have a bit more of a bit more triumphant ending. And one last thing about that, I think that the theatrical version also helps build up the title, whether you call it Exorcist 3 or just Legion, because two people in a body is not a legion. Now, three people, which is what the theatrical cut implies, because the theatrical cut seems to really imply that Pazuzu is in there too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Karras and Gemini and Pazuzu, and, you know, and whether or not Pazuzu is Satan or if Satan is also in the mix or what, like, there's, yeah, there is a bit more of a Legion quality that they are many all sort of living inside of that body. And in fact, there was a scene that they supposedly shot that no one has seen and that Blatty didn't like, wherein the faces keep changing, and it's not just that you're going back and forth between Dourif and Miller, but that you see other people.
It's in the trailer, but it's not in the actual movie.
Yeah, and also that they use a sort of asexual voice that could be a man's voice or a woman's voice, kind of similar
like
to the voice in the original. Yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of an interesting idea. But here's the thing that I have thought about for a little bit. The book, Legion, is split between two protagonists, one of them being Kinderman, who is the character that they go with in this movie, but then there's also a doctor character who is kind of got some kind of lesions on his brain that's making him see things, and he's seeing like an alternate evil version of himself, and you know, it's a question of, you know, whether or not these are the lesions or something more. And as a result, the blurring of what is real and what is in the mind. And, you know, is there such a thing as demonic possession or is it just mental illness is in the book. It's a thing that is present in Legion, the novel, that is not at all in the film. And I have to say, I kind of wish that they had gone with the doctor character instead. I kind of think that would have been a really interesting movie.
I could see that. What I was thinking about actually earlier about this, the way that the Gemini killer operates in this movie is that he possesses people who are suffering from severe mental illness, dementia patients, stuff like that. And it brings to mind a kind of what I think is an interesting spiritual question about something like this. There's always, in philosophy, there's this, a lot of modern and classical philosophy talk about the division between mind and body, and especially the idea of the soul. How much, considering how easy it is for him to possess people who basically have lost most of their faculties, does this seem to imply that the mind and soul are more closely linked, that a soul is weakened or it's not entirely there when it is suffering from that kind of illness?
It's a good question. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. Like I said, Exorcist 3 to me is incredibly dense. There's just, for something that I think kind of has a simple plot, who those characters are and the questions that they're dealing with, and certainly, yeah, like, hosting most of this film in a hospital, and specifically in some of the sections of the mental ward, do raise a lot of big questions, including that. And yeah, I mean, like, that's a big part of the original Exorcist, is that, you know, modern science can't always explain everything. And you can try and you can try and you can try, but at some point, you have to sort of go back to something that is primordial in hope that that will provide an understanding of what the nature of man, mind, body, and soul, and how all of these things operate together, and if there is such a thing as a contamination to that, how one even begins to diagnose and heal that. Dr. Vincent Amfortas, who is the doctor in the novel, I think if they had included him, you would have gotten even more of that, potentially, which, I mean, to me, that's really, really, really intriguing. But there are some good scares. I think that the scene that people most often point to, there's a scene with a nurse.
Yep. In my opinion, the best jump scare in all of cinema. Maybe the Luton bus competes with it, mostly because of its importance in horror film history. But hot damn, the nurse scene in Exorcist 3, just that build, it's like 5 minutes of nothing, of build up, and I think at least one false scare, but not like a really bad false scare. It's more understandable one. Then we think that she's safe, ha ha ha. Then quick zoom.
Oh yeah,
Her crossing from one side of the hall to the other. Quick zoom. Person behind her in sheet with the big garden shears.
And it's great because I don't really believe that even by 1990, the jump scare had been quite perfected in that way. And I do think a lot of people have sort of aped that particular move since then. It feels very familiar now when you watch it. You go like, oh, I've seen that before, but I'm not really sure how many times it had really existed previous to just the way that it's executed so well. And then, what do you think of the dream sequence? It's a weird one.
I have no idea. I have so many things. I'm not even sure how to parse some of this. Partially from a jokey perspective, man, heaven is so good that it can sew people's heads back on, but it kind of leaves an interesting scar. Also, Fabio's there for some reason.
Yeah, I think there's a couple. There's like a whole bunch of people that are in the background of those scenes. And also, isn't Sam Jackson in this movie technically? I think he shows up real brief for like a hot second.
It's not a disturbing sequence, but you know, we say sometimes movies are dreamlike, but that sequence in particular, for a dream, it is exactly as dreamlike as it's supposed to be. It is surreal. The camera angles just seem kind of odd. It has this kind of smoky look to it. The way how casually people act. Some of them act just downright weird, like the like people who are operating. It's like heaven's trying to contact Earth with ham radios, saying, "Can you hear us, Earth? We're trying to communicate with you." And a guy who is like, who I think is either deaf or blind, or possibly both, saying, "Then humanity is deaf," or something like that. The world is deaf, something like that. Like they can't hear heaven trying to contact them.
It's just, you look at it, and again, it's just one of these weird moments. It's this weird piece of the puzzle.
That definitely seems like it would work better in the book than it would in film, because again,
it made me giggle a little bit by accident. Yeah, because like Fabio just like stares at the camera like, I can't believe it's not butter. And I'm like, I can't believe you're in this movie, Fabio. But yeah, it's like, it's weird and interesting and maybe a little, again, like offbeat. Feels a little strange compared to the look and feel of the rest of the movie, but it's. I just think Blatty, like, he took a lot of risks. It's not, especially because of his intention with the original cut of it. It really doesn't feel like an Exorcist movie, because what it is a demonic possession story by way of Silence of the Lambs before Silence of the Lambs was a movie.
Yeah.
So, like, that's really, you know, like, I don't think anybody knew at that point in time that there was going to be, this sort of, like, Anthony Hopkins, Jodie Foster thing that was going to become one of the most influential thrillers in the history of cinema. It's weird because I do kind of think in a way that this movie kind of does it first with George C. Scott and Brad Dourif. It's, you know, it's a lot of the same stuff in both the theatrical and the director's cut. It's sort of like these big complex conversations wherein George C. Scott is talking to somebody, you know, as a cop, talking to somebody who is behind bars about who the real killer is. And it obviously, because there's this possession angle, the person behind bars can also be the person out in the world. But but it is still, I think at its heart has this sort of, like this element of like Clarice Starling talking to Hannibal Lecter to it before that was a thing, which is kind of cool.
Now, one of the big criticisms I will give to the movie, and this ties in with the ending, since we need an exorcism scene in this movie, we need a priest to perform that exorcism, and the character of Father Mourning, and I say character very loosely because he appears in all of one friggin' scene before the exorcism. The scene right before it establishes that he performed an exorcism once. But that's it. He has a completely silent scene where he is at the hospital. He's the resident priest. Basically, he's the guy who chaplain. He's the chaplain at the hospital. It's this weird sequence where like he's reading his Bible, a bird he's taking care of dies, wind blows, his crucifix falls off the wall, and the little statue of Jesus on it bleeds from its eyes, and wind blows the Bible, and that's it. That is all you're established with this character. So by the time the exorcism scene actually happens, he appears in the doorway and just like, who the hell is this guy? Because you've completely forgotten about him at this point.
And unfortunately, also, I mean, there's an added element, which is that Nick Williamson he was a man suffering. He smoked like 80 cigarettes a day and was a pretty severe alcoholic. So I don't know that he was really able to give it his all at that point. Like,
although even a phoned-in performance from him, he has that amazing voice.
Yeah, no, for sure. That is certainly one thing. But, you know, again, when you're going to naturally compare this with the original Exorcist and, like, forget it. Forget it. Nothing's better than the exorcism scene of that movie. It's the best exorcism of all time.
I do like the exorcism scene, though, as a spectacle, though, because one of the things I like about the fact that we do have Pazuzu still in this movie, he was only in Reagan for pretty limited amount of time. I'd say, what, like a few months at most?
Yeah, at most.
Versus in this movie, he's been basically festering in the body of Father Karras for about 15 years, growing power. So he starts off with some taunts and, you know, some light hallucinations with snakes and everything like that. But then it's like you show off just how powerful and dangerous this is. And also why you should probably have two people performing an exorcism and not just one.
Yeah, for sure.
Because he blows up the Bible and telekinetically knocks him into a wall, like peels his skin. It's just like, oh, wow, this might have been a bad call here.
Yeah, you don't ever want to bring a Bible to a super devil fight. Like, that's not, you're right. You're absolutely right that 15 years festering inside of one particular form for the most part is probably going to give Pazuzu a little, Captain Howdy is more like Admiral Howdy.
Mm.
Kind of tough to face off against that dude.
It's not pea soup anymore. It's fire and brimstone and when Kinderman shows up, you know, the freaking ground breaks off and demons are like trying to crawl out of hell.
Yeah, I don't know, man. If it was me, you know, I'd have been like, Kinderman, I'm Jewish, so we don't believe in that stuff. No such thing as the devil. And he would have been like, I am defeated. Should have just did that, man. That's how you crack that case. I always say the same thing every time in these movies. I'm like, send in the rabbi, dude. Rabbi's got this on lock.
I am very happy that we don't have an inverted cross in this movie. We have the bleeding statues, but we never see an inverted cross, because it's one of those things in movies that always bugs me, in possession movies like this, that always bugs me, because of course an inverted cross is actually a legitimate Catholic symbol. It's the sign of St. Peter, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, looking at you, Conjuring 2 and about a million other movies.
I still haven't seen Conjuring 2. I like the first Conjuring.
It's not a... You can critique a thing and still like the thing. Is there anything else you wanted to sort of cover? Because we've talked about a lot.
Some things in the theatrical cut that I... One thing I especially liked in the theatrical cut that did not make it into... In the director's cut that didn't make it into the theatrical. There's more bits where... Kinderman is visiting Father Karras in the hospital where, like, a nurse keeps coming to the wrong room to do stuff. We kind of see some of that here, but not as much in the director's cut, where it's established that something's weird is going on at this hospital. It's very poorly administered. The administration is not working right, and it's foreshadowing for what we learn about what's his name? Doctor, the guy who basically pointed Kinderman in the direction of the man in cell 11.
Oh, you're talking about Dr. Temple.
Dr. Temple, yes.
Played by the late great Scott Wilson.
Yeah, because Temple is basically acting as kind of a patsy for the Gemini Killer, threatening him. The Gemini Killer is I threatened him with unspeakable terrors. He just kind of laughed it off as if he wasn't actually going to do anything to him, which makes sense. We don't see any establishment that Temple has a K in his name, which was the entire Gemini Killer's thing.
Yeah, there is a point even in the director's cut where he says like, oh yeah, I threatened his family and I threatened this and I threatened that. Because he was so superstitious, he believed it. Yeah. It's nice. I'm glad you pointed that out too, just by virtue of the fact that, you know, we happen to be talking about this movie. Really, I mean, like, as of when we're recording, I believe that Scott Wilson actually just died over the weekend. He had been very recently known for being on The Walking Dead, and he's a great actor in general, and I think was a real gift to the horror community. He was really great in horror films. But that's kind of a cool thing that the hospital is kind of accidentally being or intentionally being bent to the will of this sort of demonic presence, and you get a sense that maybe, you know, the nurses are involved, the doctors are involved, they're just trying to stay alive, and you never know who it is that's going to get pulled in and is going to actually have to pay a price.
There's very rich characterization in this. Some could probably argue that it might be overacting in some places, but I kind of like that that everything that we're introduced, even if they're small parts, they make the most of it, and they do it so well. There's the nurse who seems uncaring, who calls herself a bitch. There's the sweet nurse who gets her head chopped off, or cut off, I should just say, because not chopping. Even the other detectives who help out Kinderman seem to have their own things going for them, and a bit of that same kind of world weariness, but in different ways. Just everyone in this movie, if they have speaking lines, they are just their own characters, and they're incredibly memorable, which is also kind of the problem with Father Morning, because he doesn't say a dang word until the exorcism. Maybe if you had him speak beforehand, maybe had a scene with Kinderman, it would have made him more memorable, and again, you wouldn't be wondering just who the hell this guy is once the actual exorcism scene starts.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, it's a shame. I think that there was a real limit to how much they could go back and change things. It's still interesting to me that you like the... I'd be curious to see if other people also really like that theatrical cut, because Brad Dourif also hates it. Like, he's gone on record as saying that he thinks that the movie was great in its original form, and that the theatrical cut makes the whole film kind of mediocre.
I think he's a bit too subdued in the director's cut, honestly.
Interesting.
Having watched the original version so many times versus the theatrical cut, sorry, the director's cut, he says similar lines in places to what he says in the director's cut. Sorry, in the theatrical cut. I keep screwing that up. He says similar things, and sometimes the exact same lines, but they use a different take for it, and it's just like, I don't feel it, and that's partially because apparently they didn't like the voice modulation that was done in parts to make his voice higher or lower. To me, I like that because it kind of gives it gives a very creepy quality to some of his lines, especially, first of all, his big monologue in the middle is incredibly quotable. He just kind of, it makes me chuckle every time. He laughs for a bit, and then suddenly, deep voice, it's the smiles that keep us going, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, Brad Dourif is incredible, and I think, you know, if you were going to come up with your list of best actors in horror, he's way, way, way up towards the top, because he's just been so, so, so influential.
I'd be okay with Brad Dourif playing every villain ever, because he's just so good at it.
Yeah, he's got a real gift. I feel pretty good. We're like 46 minutes in. So here's what I'm going to say. Let's just, you know, for example... Let's say somebody listens to this podcast. They also have seen Exorcist 3, and they think, like this podcast, and you should give it 5 stars. And you also like Exorcist 3. Lewis, what is another movie that people should check out?
Definitely in terms of, I feel, dread and atmosphere and slowly building towards a somewhat big climax. If you, assuming you haven't done an everyday horror on this one, John Carpenter's The Thing.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we actually haven't done that one yet. It, I mean, I would say that's one of the best horror movies ever made, period.
Definitely. It's while Exorcist 3 is my favorite, The Thing is a contender, and I could, and if you ask me on the right day, I might say I like The Thing just a little bit more, but in general, Exorcist 3 is my favorite.
I would say that's a good choice. I would say if you watch Exorcist 3, I think probably part of the reason that you liked it so much is because of George C. Scott. And so my recommendation would be 1980s The Changeling.
Yep.
Which is another really, really great film wherein George C. Scott is the protagonist. He, again, is in that same position where he's not really sure what's actually going on. And so he's got that kind face, that big booming voice, and always that very, very strong emotional, like he could cry at any moment because he's just barely hanging on. The Changeling is a really astonishing work, and he's just so good in it. So yeah, I would say if you've seen Exorcist 3, the other thing to pair it with on my end would definitely be The Changeling.
I could agree there.
I think that is where we're going to end it. Lewis, where can people find you on the internet before we go?
They can find me on atopthefourthwall.com or just search on YouTube for Atop the Fourth Wall, AT4W, Linkara, that kind of thing.
Where can they find you on social media?
They can find me at Linkara19 on Twitter, and on Tumblr, atopfourthwall.tumblr.com, though Twitter is probably the best way to keep it, keep in touch with me and projects I'm doing.
Dope. And my name is Danny Roth. You can find me, my work is on sci-fi.com. I do, three different podcasts for them, and there's about 20 billion podcasts that we do, part of the Sci-Fi Wire podcast family. You should listen to all of them. I'm not even contractually obligated to say that. They're all that good. There's videos and features if you feel like reading for a change. And if you want to find me on Twitter and Instagram, you can find me at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary also with one N. Thank you for listening, and remember, sometimes the best cure for the horrors of every day is a little everyday horror. We'll see you next time.